Welcome to the China in the World podcast, a series of discussions examining China's foreign policy and shifting engagement with the world. Brought to you by the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing and hosted by Paul Hanley.
Welcome back to the China in the World podcast. I hope everyone is doing well, staying safe and healthy. Today, I'm pleased to welcome back to the podcast, Professor Jia Dazhong. Many of our listeners will remember Professor Jia from our interview back in April of 2017. We talked just on the heels of President Xi Jinping's first meeting with Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago. Wow, it was more than 3 years ago, believe it or not, and my, how times have changed since then. Professor Jia is a professor of international political economy at the School of International Studies, Beijing University. He's one of China's foremost experts on traditional and non-traditional security issues, and he's, of course, a keen observer of the U.S.-China relationship. He previously served as the inaugural Rio Tinto China Fellow at the Lowy Institute, and was also an Arthur Ross Fellow at the Asia Society. Most enviable of all, he earned his PhD in political science at the beautiful University of Hawaii's East-West Center. Dazhong, welcome back to the podcast. It's good to have you back.
It's my pleasure, Paul, and I hope back in the States you are safe and sound, and so are your family and friends.
Well, we're doing okay. We're looking forward to getting back to China when conditions allow it. We miss our friends and our home there, and we're looking forward to getting back eventually. But thank you for joining the podcast remotely, virtually.
It's my pleasure.
So I read recently your piece in the South China Morning Post, and I was intrigued by it, as I mentioned to you. Arguing that China should not restrict drug exports to the U.S. in response to new U.S. export controls and domestic regulations that complicate China's access to semiconductors. Let me just start by asking, you know, what inspired you to write the piece? It was not an issue that I was tracking very closely, but I'm always following your work, and I was just interested in what inspired you to write this piece.
Well, that piece all came by accident. As usual, when I come to my office in the morning, I log on a number of newspaper websites. And there was a heading saying that a prominent Chinese economist was saying things, as you just summarized, that China had the option of using medicines and medical products as a quote-unquote weapon against the U.S. Restricting sales of semiconductors to China. I immediately recalled that this was the second time the same economist in the same news was quoted to be saying the same thing in the over a year. I think the last time he said something, he was quoted to have said something similar was 2019. Mm-hmm. And of course, this time around, the reader's attention is very different. And I felt very strongly about the possible messages people might interpret, because the economist in question is also a member of the political consultative committee of the part of the governance structure of the central government. And frequently Chinese scholars, especially from Beida and the Tsinghua universities, are understood to be somehow close to the government or to be representing a governmental view. But to my knowledge, I'm actually fairly extensively involved in some of the discussions over COVID-19 response, and I mean the international cooperation part of it. There was no mention of that at all. And he was for sure articulating a very personal view. I just wanted to do some correction. more than that, I deeply believe that there should be limits to tit for tat. As I wrote in that piece, that that idea of using a medicine, either by China or by the US or by any third party, no matter who is the target for what reason, you know, weaponizing medicine, it's just against humanity. It's not an option, should not be an option. That's why I wrote it.
You know, what is going on? Many of us argued that this coronavirus should have been an opportunity for the US and China to work together. When I served in government, and even since I've served in, you know, worked at the Carnegie Endowment and have been involved in Track 2 unofficial dialogue, global pandemics have always been an area where we agreed that if such a thing happened, we would work together. That and other transnational issues, you know, have always been an area of agreement between the US and China that we would work together. But this one has only intensified the downward pressure on the relationship. And I'm wondering, from your perspective, why is that? Why have we been unable? Why is the rhetoric coming out of the US and China towards each other much more antagonistic now? Why are the narratives in both capitals starkly different and confrontational? What is happening in the relationship that's leading to this?
Well, as far as I know, I read historical descriptions about history. I also talk to some of the professionals, although I myself am not, you know, a health industry person in any sense of the term, and I'm a political scientist by training. I really see the failure of cooperation over COVID-19 response as a culmination of the gradual but nevertheless determined thinning of cooperation between the health research and management agencies between of the two countries. The effective channel of communication among the health public health agencies, and along with that, there was a reduction of, let's say, the kind of personal level synergy between the experts, the practitioners of public health on both sides.
But, you know, this particular health crisis, statements that you hear from senior officials in the White House, you know, calling this coronavirus situation China's Chernobyl, meaning that, you know, they compare it to the Soviet Union's cover-up of the meltdown, the Chernobyl nuclear power plant back in 1986. The National Security Advisor, Robert O'Brien, has said publicly that, you know, Beijing knew what was happening with the virus, but lied to the WHO, prevented outside U.S. experts and other international experts from accessing information. And they've been very, you know, forceful in their criticism. I mean, how do you see this from the Chinese perspective? What is there? I mean, is there something there, or is this all politics in your view?
Let me put it this way. Before the closure of border, that's toward the end of January, to travelers from China, especially the Chinese passport holders by the United States, I actually was looking for news reports and also looking at comments by CDC experts via the internet. There was a sharp contrast. The CDC experts were giving their professional assessments, but the public media, like you said, were looking at this immediately, going, you know, framing this as a issue of political system. The Chernobyl analogy was sort of saying, you see, you know, the communist system in China was not going to work. This is the moment that we've been waiting for. I was totally disappointed that during the first few weeks of the crisis here in China, you had more coverage of an actress who was born in Wuhan, acting out in a Hollywood movie, Mulan, than what was really going on in Wuhan. There was no expression of empathy or sympathy. That, to me, was a very sad and a failure, frankly speaking, of professional journalism. But during that time, I actually got a phone call from one of those journalists calling me from London. And he asked me all of those questions that were politics and ideology based. I got so angry and said, is that all you wanted to talk to me about?
Yeah. But I noticed in certainly social media early on, there was a lot of frustration as well at the way it was being dealt with by government officials across the system.
There's no doubt about it. Partly because now we have, better telecommunications among the populace. Out of that, you have a lot of misinformation, disinformation, partial information, unprofessional stuff. But what we were angry about was that the local government, both in Wuhan and in Hubei, seemed to be getting into this sort of end of the Lunar New Year celebration mode. They were prioritizing that. And the unfortunate death of Dr. Li Wenliang and others, and there were six medical doctors in his hospital that lost their lives. There continues today, actually, to be open criticism of the head of that hospital, who was just recently removed from her post. So it's not so much that here in China, we have only one rhetoric saying everything went perfect. There are a lot of things to look at. There are a lot of things to reflect upon. And it is true that some of the, it's not that we are immune to criticism, but let's put it that way.
The Chinese government has, in a very robust way, handled mitigation and containment. Stories that we hear coming out of China is that things are going back to normal, and people are going back to work. Kids are going back to school. People going back to movie theaters. Has some of the initial frustration in China at the way it was handled early on gone away because of the success of containing and mitigating the virus?
I would think the actual social, societal dynamics in China has less to do with what the government has been projecting in terms of the quote-unquote wisdom behind these intervention measures. Societal sentiment probably had more to do with, some call it culture, but I think it's probably a habit of self-protection. After all, we went through SARS, and many of us, the population that were kindergarten age, just grown up over the years to be, you know, young parents. So you had a sort of instinct of self-protection there, and the cooperation with government requirements or demands for a self-isolation was in many ways automatic.
In some ways, you know, the U.S. had not dealt with a virus of that lethality.
Of that kind of scale, of that kind of severity. But I also think this time around, China got lucky because of the broad access, the width and depth of access to the internet among the populace. there were many channels of verifying what was happening. And as you know very well, the internal migration among different parts of China has been very intensive over the past decades. So there were many channels of communication. Probably for you folks outside China, you have to rely a lot on what goes to you through the official media. But here in China, the official, I don't know. I mean, a lot of people, including my family, we don't really watch the news. We kind of check to see if I have a student in Wuhan or I have a relative somewhere else. That's more reliable stuff.
Let me ask you one more question around the coronavirus. I mentioned the rhetoric coming out of the Trump administration. We also hear, of course, you know, President Trump calling it the China virus and others in the administration, you know, blaming China. But we see a new feature on the Chinese side in terms of what's labeled wolf warrior rhetoric or wolf warrior diplomacy, where diplomats, ambassadors across the globe are using social media platforms of the U.S. to punch back, or in many ways proactively just strike out and criticize the US and other countries for their handling of the coronavirus or for their criticism of China. It's a new feature, Dao Zhong. I mean, this is very new and it's really only evolved over the last year or so. What explains this new feature of Chinese communication to the world? Is it that China is more confident now, or is it that China is in fact frustrated with some pushback it's getting from the international community? Or is it instructed by the government leadership to Chinese diplomats to engage in this kind of rhetoric? Help us understand this wolf warrior feature now.
That's certainly not a very high point in diplomacy out of China. We should not be projecting our country as such. But on the other hand, need to be a little bit balanced. I would think later on, when the Australian government came out to call for an Iraq nuclear weapons type of style of quote unquote independent inspection of the origin of the virus, handling of the virus, probably you also have a not so outspoken but salient voice among those who are, I wouldn't say appreciative, but who give some credibility to engage in that kind of rhetoric that named this a China virus, because with that comes state responsibility. We all knew how the Iraq investigation went on. And frankly speaking, did I read it correctly? There is now saying in the presidential election platforms saying that China should pay for whatever the US calculates its loss from the virus.
Are you saying that this kind of pushback is appreciated in China, that China is not going to be pushed around like that?
No, I think there is, I need to be honest, I think there is that sentiment.
Yeah. I would be remiss to not engage you on the U.S.-China relationship more broadly. I remember about a year ago, you and Orville Schell from the Asia Society published a piece in China File, where you argued that Washington and Beijing need to pull the bilateral relationship back from the brink. And, you know, we can look today at core areas of disagreement in the relationship, whether it's trade and economics, technological competition, access to next generation technologies, issues related to Chinese sovereignty in areas like the South China Sea, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Xinjiang, Tibet. These are all areas where both Washington and Beijing are now accusing the other side of trying to change the status quo, which has led to both sides implementing new policies or taking actions that in turn reinforce the other side's perception, and has created really a downward spiral in the relationship. How can we, I mean, you wrote this article about a year ago. What can we do to pull the relationship back from the brink? A year on from your article, how do you see this issue?
You know, we understand both here in China and in the United States, we have our respective domestic political contexts. And politicians, especially in the age of very active media coverage, are held, quote unquote, accountable to their words. So it's very hard for them to backtrack or to, quote unquote, appear soft. So we're trying, that's the reason for that piece you mentioned. What I do see today is the, you know, sort of many things, is that we went from one extreme, that's during the Obama administration, of having hundreds of dialogue mechanisms. And many of those were very poorly managed with insufficient preparation on both sides. And many of them ended up being more ritualistic than substantive. To today, whereby about the only thing left is the megaphone. We have to find the middle ground somewhere.
Yeah.
For talking to each other.
I agree. I think I would argue, you know, I've heard Trump officials say, you know, we don't need to have dialogue with China. They know what they need to do to fix things. But that's not diplomacy. There is a sense in the U.S. that the dialogue mechanisms didn't really result in any progress and in really addressing issues in any serious way. And I think I would argue that we need communication channels, but we also need to make sure they're results oriented. And so I hear my Chinese friends say, we need more communication. I hear the Trump administration say, we need more results. And so I conclude we need more results oriented communication. I think that's the happy medium.
I agree with you. Look, the argument that comes out of the White House or Washington, D.C. saying, well, you have that dialogue fatigue, you have that, you know, communication was not productive, and coupled with some broad brush calls for conversation and understanding from China, that's a no-go. We are stuck. But let's face it, the two political capitals operate on two, let's, physical time clocks. You know, we are on different sides of the globe. What's said about the other, about the domestic situation, the mental audience is domestic. You have a time zone gap. You have difficulties in translation. You also have quite possibly selective translation and selective interpretation. Dialogue itself does not resolve the things. But then between China and the United States, you don't have that magical point whereby you get it done and then everything else gets resolved automatically. But in a very strange way, I actually think the modality behind the working modality behind the trade deal signed between Lighthizer and Liu He is probably one way to go forward. In other words, both governments should probably be encouraged to think along a line like this. You identify a specific issue, you have specific markings of progress, you have a mechanism to come back and double check on it. The last thing we should be doing is to continue today the situation today of saying, which really, you know, is aggregating all and any discussions to be about the structure of the world politics, to be about, you know, geopolitical this, the geopolitical that. And that's not going to work.
Now, one of the most contentious issues in the U.S.-China relationship over the decades has been Taiwan. We agreed to disagree early on during the normalization of relations. It hasn't gotten any better. Just last week, 10 days ago, we saw over 40 Chinese warplanes cross the median line in the Taiwan Strait and enter Taiwan's air defense identification zone. This unprecedented level of military activity by China coincided with a visit to Taiwan by the U.S. Undersecretary of State for Economic, Energy, and Environmental Affairs, Keith Krach, that same weekend. And, you know, it's interesting because I know this is a hotly debated topic in China. In the U.S., there are some scholars now, and even some in the Trump administration, debating the need whether or not we should formally shift U.S. policy from one of strategic ambiguity to one of strategic clarity. That is to say that the U.S. government should make explicit that the U.S. would respond to any Chinese use of force against Taiwan. I want to just check whether you have been observing that debate in the United States and what's your reaction to that. How would that be viewed in China? And what kind of debates are taking place in China now on the issue of Taiwan?
There are great difficulties in communication, even about topics like the technicalities of energy policy, which I work on a lot. The language, specific terms used, and conceptual and historical contexts. I gave a talk in Taipei on what I understood to be energy policies, beginning with import to storage and then to refining and whatnot. I thought that was, and I'm not a technician, but, you know, we went back and forth just clarifying it. We spent most of the time trying to clarify each other. What I'm really trying to say is that it's just as unfortunate that interactions between the two societies here on the mainland over there in Taiwan sometimes get aggregated to choices of independence versus not. I'm not saying I'm sympathetic or supportive of that, but nevertheless, if when you do have developments that in ties between Taiwan and the United States, no matter what was said, what was implied back in 1971, 72, and 79 with those joint communiques.
Yeah.
If somehow Taiwan is saying that that piece of land can be used as a launch pad, may not be actual attack, but the launch pad for a foreign military against the mainland, that's not going to be tolerated. And now this sounds hawkish, it sounds mainland, but regardless of history or whatnot, it's sort of like, you know, you had a Cuban situation back in the US, back in the 60s, 70s, and the US has taken decades to get over that. This may not be as appreciated outside China because it's outside the mainland, because it's often portrayed as a competition or struggle among different political systems or not. So that's probably what I have.
We are just over a month out from the U.S. presidential election. And I know there's a lot of speculation over who China would prefer to see sitting in the White House next January. I remember Dao Zhong, when you joined the podcast, just after the meeting between President Xi and President Trump at Mar-a-Lago, there was hope that Trump and Xi would reorient the relationship in a more positive direction. In China, when they look at the U.S. presidential election, is there a preference for one over the other in terms of who becomes president in January 2021?
I doubt it. Very much doubt it. This is a serious statement. Back in 2016, leading up to the voting, you had one after another American scholars or former officials coming to Beijing to tell us what was going on and to share your sentiments. In hindsight, at least I myself feel we were collectively here on the Chinese side, here in Beijing at least, too slow to appreciate the kind of sentiment, even anxiety on the part of the visitors. And I myself were raising eyebrows sometimes, you know, it's sort of, yeah, you have an election, it's your election, what more do we need to know, right? I had that sort of sentiment. And it turned out, you know, we had a lot to regret over that kind of reaction. But this time around, mainly because of the pandemic, but probably equally because of the overall change in tones in contacts and plus the restrictions on the diplomatic contacts. Diplomats contacting ordinary folks, including scholars like me. We don't know what to sense, what to feel, not F-E-A-R, F-E-E-L, what to feel, the sentiment that are driving voters to cast the votes one way or another. So it's dangerous, extremely dangerous to assess what the election is for future U.S. policy toward China by just reading commentaries. Because, like I said before, you have a time zone lag, and you also have difficulty in translation. But the bottom line is that I do believe we don't have a clear preference, at least not clear. Anyone who tells you there is a preference, it's probably a poorly informed hunch. And overall, I would think the sentiment is wait and see.
So let me conclude by looking out at the future a little bit. You know, unfortunately, right now, I think we are, U.S. and China are doing a lot of talking past each other. We're not talking to each other. We're talking past each other. The narratives in each country could not be more different or antagonistic. We're blaming each other for the deterioration in the relationship. But many think that political events this fall in the U.S. could provide opportunities to put the U.S.-China relationship on better footing. So I would argue that the period we're in right now, even though it's pretty volatile between the U.S. and China, I think it calls for a great deal of self-reflection in both yes. China and the U.S. And during one of my last China in the World episodes, I interviewed Professor Chen Dingding, who said to me, he said, when it comes to U.S.-China relations, it takes two hands to clap. And I cannot agree more with him. I think that, you know, the idea that one side takes all the blame for the deterioration in the relationship, I think is, it doesn't reflect reality. And I think both sides need to take agency in the relationship. Both sides need to be proactive and taking steps to set conditions to get the relationship on more stable footing and thinking through what can we do together? Where can we make compromise? I think the U.S. presidential election in our country provides a good mechanism for us as Americans to self-reflect and think about what we've gotten right and what we've gotten wrong on our approach to China and what adjustments we can make. I think, you know, and I hope the next U.S. administration, I can think of three things right off the top of my head that I hope the next administration, even if it's a second term of Trump or a first term of Biden, does to put the relationship on better footing. Number one, instead of just admiring or identifying problems in our relationship with China, let's move to a problem-solving mode, try to address these problems constructively, try to either manage them or resolve them. That would be number one. Number two, I think, tone down the damaging rhetoric that you hear from the U.S. leadership. And three, as we've talked about already, reestablish these communication channels, which I think are essential to solving problems. So I could go on about what the U.S. administration should do, but I want to ask you for your last question, Dao Zhong. As China self-reflects on China's approach to the U.S.-China relationship, on its policies, on its rhetoric, on its behavior, where do you see the greatest opportunity for China to take agency in the relationship, for China to proactively address issues, to convey willingness to make modifications or compromise in addressing concerns by the U.S. side? And if the politics in the U.S. this fall allow for positive changes in the U.S. approach to China, will Chinese politics allow for corresponding shifts from the Chinese side?
Well, the most difficult part, I agree with what you said, and that's why I'm on your program, frankly speaking. This is not, I would never get on Fox.
This is not Fox.
Okay. But and totally, you know, the real competition between China and the U.S. or for any society, very much like for an individual that had relationship either problems, either at home, you know, under the same roof or in the neighborhood, the real competition is the willingness and capacity to reflect and self-change and act upon it. You demonstrate goodwill through action and not repetition of words. That's so commonsensical. But the true difficulty that's going on between our two countries is in action or a position that one party self-defines as positive, a lot of times gets interpreted, either seriously understood or gets politically projected as negative, as confrontational by the other. Now, having said that, in terms, just to reciprocate what you said about what China needs to reflect upon, I would come up with a list of four things. First and foremost, we need to reflect upon the basic assumptions about U.S. policy toward China or a specific deed. And a lot of times, there is this tendency of aggregating, of saying, well, let's not lose sight of the forest, see more than the tree. And that kind of sentiment a lot of times imposes a lot of understanding on what American and, you know, intent is and whatnot. So we need to seriously reflect ourselves upon that. And secondly, earlier you mentioned a number of issues, and foreign criticism of China is not automatically confrontational. I understand this is very difficult for our diplomats and for many of my colleagues to admit, at least not on these kind of forums, or to say so. You know, it's kind of like someone making a negative comment or suggestion to you as a person. And in many instances, you need to be thankful because it's a reminder of something possibly worse down the road. And that should be a source of it's not the criticism itself, how it's sounding. Well, earlier you mentioned wolf diplomacy, the words that are designed to get into a rhetorical fight. Yeah. It's taking those criticisms as cues and to say, well, yeah, there are policies we can change, we should change. Deng Xiaoping was a good example. Right after Tiananmen 1989, there was so much criticism, there was so many dire predictions, there were sanctions. But his act that showed reflection was, you know, his personal tour to the south of China, 1992. Yep. And that's the kind of thing I would like to see happening more here in China. You know, we are a country of a lot with a huge reservoir of wisdom, let's put it that way.
And
So that's a second point. Now, a third point in terms of relating to the United States, and this is so difficult, but it needs to be talked about at least, is that Congress, you know, you have so many congressmen who may not actually have a real handle of what's going on over a particular issue here in China. They get their hands on some, let's say, advocacy group of reports. A lot of that is just words. And this Congress may be working out of good intent, but that's how issues like Xinjiang or whatnot get into legislation. Many of us here, including educated folks like myself, what, Xinjiang, what happened, right? And this is, we need to deal with this. It's not just the White House. It's not just the diplomats assigned to the jobs. How do we address this? Because here in China, these things are related to us, but with a lot of these punitive legislative actions, and they are as powerful as presidential decrees. We don't really get a hearing, we don't really get a say, and between our National People's Congress, there is very thin level of interactions. I know the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations over the years have tried very hard to get some conversations going. And so long as we have a continuation of here in China, many people say, oh, okay, we tried, but who do we try with? Is this each and every of these congressmen, or is it just the White House? And that this is a real issue. And we need to reflect upon it. We need to work harder on relating to the US political system more fully. Last but not least, China is not the United States in the sense that we have a very different neighborhood. China needs to work way harder on getting its relationship with its neighbors to be less acrimonious and to, you know, work on this issue by issue. And then that would also help to reduce the burden of bilateral ties between China and the United States.
Those are four very good points. And I appreciate your candor. I think that we need to have better understandings of our political systems, our congresses. And as you said earlier, how we think about each other, the broader populace, not just the government. And we need to try to take steps to actually do things together to show that the US and China can both compete, but also work together. And there are challenges, and we need to acknowledge that. But we need, I think, a much more robust and constructive effort in addressing these problems. But it will take both sides stepping up and being proactive, offering compromise and concessions, and not just one side and the other side waiting for the one side to come to the table. So, you know, I hope we can take advantage of any opportunities to present themselves in the fall or early next year. And this kind of dialogue will help us get there. So I very much appreciate you sharing your perspective, spending time with me today. Always good to talk to you, Dao Zhong. Thank you very much. And we look forward to having you back on the show.
Great. Thank you very much. And I look forward to seeing you again here in Beijing or back in the States at some point of time.
Well, I hope it's in Beijing soon. That would be nice.
Okay.
All right, my friend. Take care. Good to talk to you.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the China in the World podcast. For more episodes and research, please go to carnegiechinghua.org. This episode was produced by Lucas Cheyenne with assistance from Madison Reed, Luke Incarnation, Li Qi Xu, John Ferguson, and Sophia Rosso.